Sports Without Balls fans, this is your host, Aaron Foley. And before we start episode 38, oh my God, 38, two more than 36. I'd like to give a shout out to allthingscomedy.com. We're recording live in their studio today for the first time. And sometimes I say that, but we're really here. Carol's under the table eating donuts. Everything's going to be fine. Allthingscomedy.com hosts this amazing podcast and all kinds of podcasts. I just said my podcast was amazing. I meant other podcasts that are amazing, but I think this is as well. So go to allthingscomedy.com. Check them out. A couple things. My buddy Tom Segura, whose podcast is called Your Mom's House, he does it with the fantastic Christina Pazinski. He has a new comedy special on Netflix called Completely Normal, which is hilarious because he's not. Rent it, watch it. He's amazing. Another shout out to our dumb friends, Dan St. Germain and Sean Donnelly. They're super fun buds. I did an episode with them about a couple weeks ago. So watch. You could watch. There's nothing to see, but you definitely listen to that podcast. Okay, we're going to start. We're doing this. Episode 38. You know, in television, when they go, we have a very special episode tonight. You guys, we have a very special podcast today. And I have to lower my voice. We have a professional. When I say we, I mean me. I have a professional in the studio. She is a senior writer for ESPN the magazine. She writes about sports. She lives, eats, and breathes sports. She's on camera reporting all the time. Please welcome, you guys, Alyssa Roenick to the show. Yay! Look at this. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much.
I'm so excited you're here.
My publicist as well as the host of this podcast, apparently.
Before we start, Sports Without Balls fans, this is a huge treat because this woman has covered 5 Olympics, 20-plus X Games, 4 Super Bowls, multiple college championships. She broke a huge story on the Seattle Seahawks and in last August told everyone they were going to win the Super Bowl. She is 4 feet away from me. This is just wonderful.
And according to that, I feel like I'm 72.
She started when she was 6.
Let's dial back the number of X Games.
She just covered her first X Games in the fall.
There are 7 a year.
There's actually like a lot
of
X Games.
Sometimes last year there were 6, but
last year there were 6 X Games.
There were.
By the way,
all over the world.
This podcast, we're going to go in 85 different directions because it could be 17 hours because there's so much I want to discuss. Let's just start with X Games because we just said X Games. I didn't realize how many X Games sports there were. I mean, really, a dude, it feels like he could put on like a pair of high tops, load something up in his wheelbarrow, and it would be like, wheelbarrow X Games.
It started that way, I do think, in 95 at the first, and now it's pared down and pared down to the sort of traditional extreme sports.
Yeah, flipping over a bike over like a
and now it sort of started ramping up the other way. We as soon as we introduced engines with rallycross, well, certainly with motocross in 99, yeah. And then rallycross, and now we've got truck racing and Austin.
It's unbelievable. I don't know what these got, like, well, obviously it's men and women, which is super exciting, but I don't know how. I guess it sort of has to be like maybe it runs in the family, or I don't know what motivation you have. You're like, all right, well, I've got a bike. Like when I look at a bicycle, I'm like, I'll ride it to point B and then I'm done. And they're like, no, I'm gonna take that bike and flip it over, you know, my mom's house for seven. You know, it's amazing.
That was exactly what drew me to these sports and what fascinated me about them.
Really?
Is most of them, because these sports are so young, it came from an internal, you know, most of us, we get a dirt bike and we just want to ride it,
yeah,
race it around. And a Travis Pastrana at 7 years old went, what happens if I take my hand off? What happens if I take 2 hands off? What if? What if? And something internally drove him and a handful of other people to create these sports. But that's what fascinates me, that drive.
And the book you wrote, was that about Travis?
It was, yeah.
And so he does, what is it, you know, because I look at it and I'm like, oh, dirt bike. But like they always have like really technical names. What is his?
He made his name first doing supercross, motocross and supercross, which was racing. And
okay.
Then freestyle motocross, which is what you're talking about.
Where they flip up
over mom's house.
I don't know. It's unbelievable to me because that would be the last thing I thought of. You know what I mean? I'd be like, you know, I'm going to jump on the bike and go to happy hour. And they're like, no, we're going to do no hands. It's unreal. So you've been covering the X Games since like the start of the X Games?
No, 2002.
2002.
Yeah, it started, I was still in high school.
Okay, and, right.
I've been covering X Games sports since 2002.
And so have you, when you started covering them, like you were already like a fan of these sports? Like did you ever like dirt bike and do all this stuff? Like how did you, like how did it pique your interest?
Yeah, you know, I'm almost embarrassed to say as a sports fan, I wasn't. I was, you know, I think back and I'm not sure that I knew the difference between Tony Hawk and Tony the Tiger in 2002, you know, and I'm not kidding. But yeah. I surfed and I snowboarded and I had a passion for some of these sports.
Yeah.
And I grew up in Florida and Pittsburgh in Florida, and I just never had an awareness that these were competitive sports as well. And they weren't for a while. The X Games weren't really on my radar. I was a pretty stick and ball sports fan.
Yeah.
I came to ESPN as a football writer, and I had an editor who, you know, I wasn't full time, and he knew I really wanted to be.
Yeah.
I made it very well known. You know, I was that girl who would like show up at your lunch table. You know,
hey, what are you guys working on?
Exactly. Exactly. I joined the softball team and anything else. And,
yeah.
And he said, tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, I hear you love to snowboard." And that was, you know, that moment is what has led to this. And so a job was open covering action sports, and I fell in love. And I remember the moment I first stood and watched someone backflip a dirt bike over my head. And growing up in gymnastics and knowing how hard it is just to backflip your body and to do this with a 250-pound machine attached to you.
I don't even know.
It blew my mind. And yeah. I just was immediately talking to them and listening to the way that their minds worked and the way that they looked at possible. You know, the things that we think are impossible, they're just simply trying to figure out, well, what do I need to do to make it happen? And so I was immediately drawn and blown away, and I never turned back.
When I think about all those like extreme sports, well, I drive a 97 Toyota Corolla, so I think that's pretty extreme. But I can't, the level of like just full on like, there's no fear, you know? There's absolute, well, first of all, I think to be a professional athlete, there has to be like no fear because it's unbelievable. I mean, you can, you know, pitchers in the off season, we had two pitchers get hit in their head by like line drives and get like metal plates in there, like a butt, like that dude from the Cardinals. But to me, that is taking like, you know, the ultimate risk. And in Sochi, you just got back from Sochi. I love that I just said that. I know someone that just got back from Sochi. All right. So here's, I know I'm going to jump all along, but that's what I do. And I also drank a lot
of
coffee.
It's an extreme podcast.
It's an extreme, you guys, it's an extreme, episode 38 extreme podcast. Sochi, now you've covered a whole bunch of Olympic games. First of all, summer or winter, like what's your favorite summer or winter?
Winter is easier because there are fewer sports, same with the X Games.
Yeah.
You know, I think I used to say summer because those were the sports I grew up doing. So I remember in Beijing looking down and having, I was in Beijing. I guess I knew I was in Beijing, but I didn't really have an awareness that I was in Beijing covering the Olympics. And all of a sudden I saw the front page of ESPN.com and, you know, the dateline 2008, you know, Beijing, China, 2008 in a dash, and my story letting the world know who won the all around in gymnastics and my byline. And I just went, whoa, that's me. I'm in Beijing doing that, you know? And it was the coolest moment in track and field and all these sports that I grew up doing and loving.
Yeah.
Having the privilege to be there in person and witness this and talk to the athletes afterwards and ask them, you know, what they were thinking, what they were eating, what they were, you know, how they prepared. And that was really special. Winter, I now, because they've added so many more of the sports that I
cover like X
regularly,
Games now.
I really enjoy winter, you know, and I got to eat. There are days when we have an off day, getting to go snowboard with my friends in the Russian mountains was pretty cool.
Wow.
In Krasnaya Poliana. So I really enjoy winter now, I think, because of those moments and because I really love doing a lot of those sports as well. And there's just fewer. It's usually less spread out. Summer Olympics are just
it's a free for all. It's awesome. It's so funny because I get like crazy. I get crazy into like billiards, but you know, the Olympics I go, you know, I obsess about. But and now, you know, the interesting thing is too, because they're covered to such an extent now. You know, growing up, you know, you'd wait all day and you'd get, you know, by the TV with your family and be like, all right, who won? You know, and now I can watch. I was getting up and I was on the road a lot in the spring. So I'd get up at like 6-7 in the morning to get the live. Like I'd be watching, I'd have to watch the live ice skating or whatever it was at like 7 in the morning because, well, one, I was performing at night when they, you know, but then I'm like, I'm on ESPN so much and ESPNwomen.com so much that I'm like, I can't not go on there. And every time you refresh, you get a score. So I'm like, all right, we'll have to watch them at 7 in the morning. But when I meet people that don't get into the Olympics, I'm like, we can't be friends. It's too much. It
sounds
too,
like just hating humanity.
Yes. I'm just like, what do you mean? Get out of my face. But just to be there and to have that excitement. So let's also talk about like the reporting aspect of it. Because we were talking about this earlier. When I think about, we just had this conversation, but when I think about like meeting my like sports heroes, like the two people I think I want to meet the most and talk about is Martina Navratilova and Derek Jeter. Like those two are like, you know, for different reasons. Mm-hmm. If I had to pick one, I'd probably pick Martina because her story is so interesting, sure, to me. So when you meet these athletes and, you know, you have to pull them aside and be like, well, how did that, you know, jump feel or how did, you know, but so is there an opportunity? Let's talk about like opportunities you get to like sit down and have a beer with them. Cause that's for me would be like probably the most exciting part.
Yeah, I think at the Olympics, no.
Yeah,
because
it's too crazy.
Yeah, even the athletes who I know really well, you know, if you have an extra, you can maybe get an extra 3 or 5 minutes with them, but it's pretty locked down. It's a tough, and you have to remember that you're going after the same story that 100 other reporters who are all in this mixed zone with you.
Is it crazy? It must be insanely competitive, right?
It is, but there's also, I think over the years, you get to know each other.
Okay.
And so it's competitive, but at the same time, if you know you're all in it together. You know, when an event ends at midnight and you're waiting for an athlete together just to get over here and give you an interview, and you know that we're all going back and we're going to be writing the story you're reading tomorrow. Between 2 and 5 a.m., we're all in it together, and there's no way we're all going to write the same story. So it becomes this really cool, helpful vibe where, hey, could I grab this quote, or are you going to transcribe that, and would you mind emailing
me
this?
Oh, that's so nice to hear.
It really is.
Yeah.
And I mean, certainly it's competitive. I want to write the best story. I want to write something that no one else wrote, an angle, you know, and we are having our own little side competition, but in the same way that the athletes say it's friendly, it is. And if I can help someone, you know, I know that I've been covering a lot of these sports that are new to the Olympics for a really long time, and a lot of my colleagues know that. I love helping them because it means that the coverage of these sports in general all over the sports journalism world is going to be better. And, you know, I love that. Yeah. I love when someone comes to me and says, like, who's in this photo? You know, what's an alley-oop? You know?
Yeah.
Because the language, you don't realize the language in snowboarding sometimes can be quite confusing.
Well, as long as you're not, you know, covering basketball, someone's like, what's an alley-oop? Because I'd be like,
quit your day job immediately. Sorry, alley-oop in the half pipe.
Yeah. Alley-oop in the
half
pipe.
It could happen. You know, that's the thing about the Olympics. You could have someone covering an NBA or an Olympic basketball game who's never covered a basketball game in their
life. These are things you don't even think about.
Oh, yeah.
But when I was watching, because we did a podcast, you know, a couple weeks ago with the Olympics, and there was definitely some new ones this year. And then when I was doing the podcast, I was like, I don't even remember what they're called because it was like slopestyle.
I listened
so
to this
cross,
podcast.
And I was just like, I can't even remember. It was so complicated.
And I was like, oh, I wish I were there.
I know.
Sort this out for them.
I know. I was like, wait, what's the one where the one to me that I think it was new and you'll know off the top of your head is when to me there was so much. Okay, well, first of all, let's establish it. It's the one that was like, it's women's and men's, and there was four or five of them. They're on snowboards.
Snowboard cross and skier cross.
Okay. That to me was so insane because obviously all of them are insanely talented, insanely skillful, but I don't even know if that's the word, skilled. But what stood out to me was like, you have to be incredibly lucky. I mean, there's so many things that could go wrong you could just be like snowboarding down and some lunatic tries to pull some move and hits your board and you're out and you've done nothing wrong.
No, it's true. Especially when they went back to six-man races, which we've used in the X Games and have been a part of the sport for a long time. But the Olympics had always been four-man. So it just ups the number of, you know, mistakes that can be made by someone other than you.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's racing. You know, if you watch the Tour de France, how many guys do you see taken out? So when you think of someone like a Lance Armstrong, everything else aside, there's luck involved in speed skating and supercross. So that's part of the excitement. But there's also a lot of strategy. Get out front. Get out front fast. Get out of the fray and learn how to, to anticipate those mistakes made by someone else. So it's really
– I would hang
really
back.
Fun
I'd, go,
for the athlete.
I'd go in the other direction. I would – the gun would be fired. Everyone would take off, and I'm like, I'm going to give it a minute. No, not a minute. I'd give it 25 seconds.
And there could be
because
you could end
it
up
just
finishing
seems like
second
it
in
was like
a pile.
Yeah. It was like a pile of carnage. It was just like waited out. Everyone tripped over. Everyone flies into each other, and then you go down.
We watched several folks who were in fifth, sixth place at the start of those races finish first, second, third.
It was ridiculous. Yeah, that
they weren't trying to be that far back, but especially with the conditions, there was a lot of patches where the best in the world were not expecting to go down. And Lindsay Jacob Ellis is down, or Nate Holland's down.
That
and
one,
the guy
Lindsay Jacob
place.
Ellis, that one made me. I'm not gonna lie, I had a moment where I had some tears. I have moments of tears pretty much every hour of the day when it comes to sports. But that just that's where I always think the Olympics are so insane to me, because it's like you train 4 years for like 2 minutes.
Right.
And if you don't get it, I always think, God, Olympians, I hope they have like really strong, like exciting personal lives, because if they don't get it, then it's like, this tragedy because they got the silver. That's the one thing that does like upset me.
Or a really
like,
good sports psychologist.
Oh my God, sports psychologist.
Strong family.
Maybe that should be like a really sweet segue into your Seattle Seahawk piece, because I do like segues and I like to call them out. In keeping with this tangential approach to a podcast, you wrote this amazing story, and people, if you haven't read it, go on ESPN.com, and it was a piece that was, what was it, the front of the ESPN magazine, NFL issue?
It was the cover story last year.
It was a cover story which you wrote about the Seattle Seahawks. Now, before I ask you a couple questions, you can go online and obviously and read it. It's pretty spectacular. It was just about a different way that Pete Carroll and the Seattle Seahawks approached, just football in general, by really treating the athletes more than just kind of weapons on the field, through meditation, through yoga, through like personal chefs checking in, through sports psychologists. And it was so interesting, because this almost feels like when I read the article, I was like, well, duh.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? It was one of these moments where I'm like, well, why wouldn't you be using all of these techniques? You know, like that to me was so interesting. But talk about, we started talking about this before we started recording the podcast. I'm like, all right, we have to save this, because I do want to talk about like how when the article came out, how it was, sort of not, well, I wouldn't say like not accepted, but it was so different. So if you could, let's just talk a little bit about that process. How did this like evolve? Like, when did you hear about it, and how long were you like at the camp?
So the sports psychologist who's working with Coach Carroll, Mike Gervais, and I have been working on a book project with a high performance scientist as well. And so I Mike had told me, I've been working with the Seahawks, and I didn't know exactly what they were doing up there, but certainly Pete's always been known as someone who sort of thinks a little differently, players first. And it was clear that something was happening up there. I mean, and in the first 2 years watching him clean house,
cleaned house.
When I went there, there were 5 men 4 years in on the roster who were on the roster when he took over.
Wow.
And that's unbelievable. So there's this sort of dichotomy between it being this really, when the story came out, people were calling it like pansy football. But at the same time, it was very hard ass football, besides of the style of play on the field, which is very hard and fast and furious. if you didn't fit, you were out. And there were I heard some really crazy but also sort of cool for a writer stories about the way in which he would decide, are you on my team? Are you with us? Against us? There was the story that I told in the actual article about him turning off the air conditioning to see who would complain, because it goes much further than just this idea of meditating or of doing yoga, or it's much more about treating players as human beings,
yeah,
and caring about the whole person, and you know, coaches, you know, no swearing, no berating players, no yelling, no talking down. It's about coaching, truly teaching. And if you were someone who easily complained and bitched and moaned and groaned about the fact that it was hot, you probably weren't going to work well in this. And he cut some pretty big name athletes, sort of, you know, with, it was inexplicable to those of us watching from the outside, but it made a lot of sense once you understood what he was doing.
God forbid you treat the player like a normal.
Well, and that was what I thought was really crazy to me. I remember walking in the first day and just being like, it feels different here. And that was the sentence that it opened the story, was him saying to me, it feels different. And that I said, absolutely.
It was training.
I felt like I was at a spa. I was up there first during mini camp. And Renton, Washington felt like a spa. But I realized it wasn't exactly what was happening. It was what wasn't happening. I'd never seen a head coach his office door open. Most of the doors were open. That's one of the rules. You should feel like you can come and go. Don't come in my office just to bitch and moan, but it's an open, you know, a bit of an open door policy. It was clean. It was very positive. And I didn't hear a lot of screaming and yelling and bitching and moaning. And, you know, and then you realize when you look at, you know, the top 100 companies to work for, it's always companies that have those sort of very positive, you know, a Google, where, you know, nutrition is thought of and the health of their
employees. A happy worker, it's, you know,
you
huge
work
amount
harder.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you think that the person sitting next to me cares about me, and hey, if I'm here to 11, he would do it too, you work harder for that person. But in sports, for some reason, we just discount all that, throw it out the window, and you're just supposed to be treated like warriors. And so he took that idea of how do you put together a Fortune 500 company? That's what I have here. And that's what my owner certainly is trying to build. And then he also looked at, you know, he very honestly said, here I am at USC. I had this really successful program with these really talented players who are winning national championships and Heismans, and they are bombing in the NFL. What am I doing wrong? How am I not preparing them? And he said the thing that he realized when players would come back to him, they would say, dude, it's not like this in the NFL. It's gnarly. It's scary. I don't know my coach. They don't care about me. And he realized that these guys at 21, 22 years old are just being thrown out. They're kids. Like, now thinking back, when I was 21, of course, I thought I was this adult and I should be, you know, go off into the world. And now I look back and think, oh my God, 21 is a kid. And for them to be thrown into this world where teams don't know them, they don't get to know them, they don't know their background, they don't know where they're coming from.
And
some of them can do well. Some people can just survive in any situation. And he talked to military experts about, you know, the guys at Hell Week who would survive no matter what help they were given.
Yeah.
There's 10 to 20% who always will. And those are the guys who succeed
in
the NFL.
But such a low percentage.
Right.
Though, you know, when you think about it, and also the shelf life of an NFL player is about 3-4 years. So to approach it in such a different way. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me because I watched the Seahawks a lot this year, and they were just like this well-oiled machine that looked like, first of all, they were having such a good time.
Exactly.
His energy on the sideline was completely infectious, you know?
Exactly.
And also, I haven't watched a Super Bowl in a really long time that it was like varsity and JV. And to think like the Peyton Manning, I just watched a lot of football. but to go in, you know, thinking, well, this is going to be like, you know, one of the best games ever, obviously toted because, you know, it's the best offense and the best defense.
Sure.
And to have such an incredible beatdown. And it wasn't even like, it was like watching, like, really, like semi-pro and pro ball. And to say that about Peyton Manning, I mean, how can you, like, and so all these things that he's doing, and they're all so positive, and I just hope that spreads. But talk about, also, I wanted to ask you about, when you first, you know, the article comes out, what's the reaction?
Your original question.
No, please.
I'll be going to politics after this. so when it first came out, I, you know, of course, was so excited. I'd been working on this for maybe 6 months, and, you know, with my editors, and we were all so excited about it. And, you know, I had an editor in chief who, you know, who believed in the story and believed it, you know, in the access. I think I all but promised him they would win the Super Bowl. Thank you, Seahawks. But when it came out, I expected it to be, you know, the biggest story. I think it was A bit, but one of the things that I was surprised about is people latched onto the yoga, which frustrated me, but I did understand that the headline and the photo, which, you know, a team of people create, and certainly they're meant to get attention.
Yeah.
You know, the photo to me of Russell in the lotus position was about him meditating and being positive and this Zen-like philosophy.
Yeah.
But, you know, I got more people reaching out to me about yoga, you know, and I was like, it was half a sentence.
Did they read the article?
It was half a sentence. Yeah. No, but that's, you know, I don't know that people read.
Yeah. It's unfortunate. There's about 10 of us left.
But, you know, the photo and the headline certainly got more attention. So that was what people were focusing on. And I didn't hear a lot of conversation. I remember watching the first game. I remember watching the San Francisco Monday night game because it was so hyped. It was the most hyped game. And it felt a little bit like the Super Bowl in that it didn't even feel like a game, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember watching Pete Carroll and Sherman chest bump on the sidelines and just thinking, like, I want to play on this team. You know, I want to play for this team, which I think is part of what he's also trying to build. And I was waiting for the guys in the booth to start talking about what was going on there, and it never happened. And, you know, I would talk to my editors and folks at the magazine, like, why don't you think this has more footing? And I think a lot of it had to do with the guys who talk about sports. This is an unusual concept. It's hard to talk about. And there was this, like, let's wait and see. You know, when this fails, let's wait and see how much he changes his philosophy. And I would go back to him, you know. Coach Carroll would laugh because I would come back and he'd be like, oh, you're back with your negative Nancy questions, you know. And I would say, like, okay, here's, you know, because my editors would say, what about this? What about this? And I would put it to him. What happens when you're 8-5? I don't have to worry about that because we won't. And this is not an experiment. This is our philosophy.
Yeah.
And we'll just stick to it even more. And when they won that night, my dad
called
me.
Blew him out.
Well, then they blew him out. And yeah, my dad called me at like midnight his time and was like so excited because Steve Young was on TV talking about my story, you know, and you know, it's not my story, you know, it's certainly writing for a magazine is a team sport as well. And it's the Seahawks story, but he was just, you know, and then I started noticing people and the folks who talk about sports and the tastemakers in NFL talking about the idea of treating athletes like humans and psychologists and getting to know your players and putting better people out onto the field and out into the world. And that was cool because that's why I thought this story was important. It wasn't because of the X's and O's things that are going on. And certainly, and that's been proven, you know, to work up there
as well. I think that's really interesting too, because do you feel like, you know, I love talking to women about sports, right? Because women in general, we just watch sports in a different way. Obviously, that's just the difference between men and women, which will be the next podcast. But, you know, we know there's 8,000 shows where you can get stats, articles on, you know, performance and bench pressing and whatever. Right. But, you know, do you think like, you know, this whole, you know, when you're talking about meditation, you're talking about doing things differently, you're talking about psychologists getting to know the player. There was really cool stories in this article about, okay, so let's say the guy has a really bad like day on the field. You know, it could be diet. It could be, all right, let's talk it out. Like, is there something happening in your personal life? All this stuff makes perfect sense, right? Obviously, you know, instead of just like, you're a horrible player, get in there and do 85 more, you know, push-ups or whatever. But I do feel like maybe it wasn't that well received in the beginning because, right, this is not a mentality. This is like a non-dude's mentality of like, hey, let's talk it out. Let's stretch it out. Let's get more protein in there. How's your day going? Right?
Right.
This is more, you know, I'm not saying it's more a female approach, but it's, you know, when I watch sports, when I think a lot of women watch sports and we talk about sports and we write about sports, it's just from a different perspective. It's more of like, I think like, you know, I like breaking down like the psychology of it all. I think it's really super interesting. Like, I think it's really interesting of like, well, what is going on in that guy's personal life? How can we help that? And, you know, get him back on. Like, also, do you think like a dude, like sports writer would have tackled this story?
I do. I think yes. I think, you know, as all women aren't the same, all men aren't the same. I don't think all male sports writers would have tackled this story or even would have kept after it. You know? But what you just said, that's what fascinates me is the psychology of sports. It's why I love action sports and Olympic sports. I think there's a really unique mentality and psychology around those sports. Yeah. But even, you know, I think that breaking – and someone like Coach Carroll, who was willing to do something so outside of the ordinary in a world that is not accepting of that.
Yeah.
You know, I talked to several sports psychologists who've been trying to get in with the NFL and get just, you know, hung up on. Even at teams that have, you know, notoriously bad problems or had had, you know, sort of bad PR.
Yeah.
Moments with off-field behavior. And it's just – it's more about accepting it. And this – you know, Mike, who works with the team, he said for him, the players – look, at the end of the day, all of this is based around being a better football player, being a better team, and winning.
Yeah.
Right? It's not just about – they're not doing this. They're not putting the money behind this and the efforts behind this just to, you know, help
– hey, you guys
you be
have
a better,
have better
human.
Days.
So they, exactly.
It's like, win the Super Bowl.
Exactly. And it, and that, no, is the end.
Yeah.
That is
yeah.
the end. The end goal. But
yeah.
getting coaches to that place, because a lot of them come from this old school mentality that to be a hard-nosed football player, you have to sort of have this hard-nosed life and you have to be screamed at and yelled at.
Yeah.
And when we stop and sort of look back, how many of us, male or female, go to work every day? And if that's the situation you're in, A, want to perform well, B, actually do perform well, and C, stick around very long. And so I think thinking that sports operates outside of the laws of just humanity is crazy.
It's ridiculous.
And I think also Pete does some smart things where he brought in Coach Carroll some military experts, you know, because what's tougher than the military? And they certainly
– podcasts.
Extreme podcasts.
Extreme sports podcasts.
Yeah. And they
and then the military.
And then the military. And they – yeah. And they found after Vietnam that – people were different and they could not treat men and women in the military the way they had been. And so they started bringing in sports psychologists and doing a lot of the things that
yeah.
Pete then has brought to the team. But by saying, here's a military expert, you know, look
hey,
at what
look.
They're doing.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, well, they're tough. We're
yeah.
tough. Okay, now I'm accepting this. And I think now people look around and go, okay, the Seattle Seahawks are tough. They're winning. Let's
yeah.
let's do what they're doing.
It's also, like, there's so many other examples. Well, not so many, but there are other examples. Like, for instance, and I hope I don't Carol slash Emmett. We might have to fact check this. I think it's Jim McDermott. I know it's McDermott from Creighton, the guard from Creighton, who just scored like something like, 3,200 points in his entire career. He just got, unfortunately, the Creighton got killed by Baylor in the tournament. But he's been using a sports psychologist for 5 years now, 4 or 5 years now. Who is it? Do McDermott Creighton. I always forget his first name for some bizarre reason. Emmett is our fact checker today because Carol. Oh, you guys, it's opening day of baseball. And Carol went out last night pretty hard with a bunch of the Dodgers. And she's under the table. Doug McDermott. Jesus. Thank you, Emmett. All right. So Doug has been I read the story. He's been using a sports psychologist for about, I think, his entire college career. So before every single game, he calls. I don't know what the psychologist's name is. Now he works with some other, you know, a bunch of players. Now he's in the stands and on the sidelines and stuff. But they go through this whole meditation routine for, you know, maybe 8-10 minutes before the game. Super positive, visualizing like him scoring, him calming himself down. And that was part of like the Russell Wilson, you know. And I mean, how chill is Russell Wilson on the football field? You're going up against Peyton Manning. The dude is just like, yeah, I just scored a touchdown. I'll just go back to the. Like, it's unbelievable, but is that zen like? And so McDermott, I mean, he plays for, you know, Creighton, who's like, Creighton's like, ah. You know, pretty good. You know, now they're technically in the Big East because Big East has exploded. But so 8 to 10 minutes before every single game, and his father's the coach, so I think that puts extra pressure on, you know, a player. He will just, and if it's an away game, he goes into part of the stadium that's quiet. He said he's done it in the men's bathroom, and people are like knocking on the door, like, who are you talking to? And eight to 10 minutes, and he will just visualize everything positive. The game slowing down, him slowing down in this, you know, crazy basketball game, because he's the number one scorer. You know, they're not going to get huge, crazy stars at Creighton, you know. And he felt so much pressure, you know, to score, to rebound, to do all these things, and now he just slows it down in his mind, and he's something like the third or fourth highest scorer in the NCAA. I know Pete Maravich is number one, and then a bunch of other guys. If he went deep into the tournament, and because he averages probably like 30 plus a game, he would have been like second, but Creighton got killed to Baylor. But it's pretty amazing. You know, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that people will take out of this is that psychology is going, you know, people have this connotation of psychology and sports psychology of treating what's wrong. I'm in a slump. I've got to go see a sports psychologist. So if you're working with a sports psychologist, something must be wrong.
Yeah.
Where today it's about high performance psychology. Mike, who works with the team, is a high performance psychologist. So he's working with the best in the world. And how can I make you better? Nothing's wrong.
Yeah.
And by doing that, I'm also studying and learning about the best in the world to help the rest of the world, those of us who aren't, you know, winning Cy Youngs, right? But every baseball player, every pitcher is benefiting from what Mike's learning by working with these guys. But at the same time, it's taking away that connotation that if you're working with a sports psychologist, something must be wrong with you.
That is so interesting because you just want to be happier as a person and better as a human and better.
We always can
be
better. Yeah,
I mean, you know.
Sure.
I visualized this podcast going extremely well, and it is. So it's, you know, it's proof right there. But baseball, I think, because it's opening day, a big shout out to the baseball season, which I'm thrilled. And I know my parents are thrilled because they retired to the Tampa area. Huge Gator fans, which we'll get to. But my parents have been married for, I think, since 1900. And they literally have like, it's like that old cranky Irish Catholic couple where they're just, they live to like, I just spent 9 days with them. So they're outrageous, but they kind of, I think they get up like, how can I get under each other's skin for about 12 to 15 hours of the day? And then they'll laugh and then they watch sports. So they're crazy Tampa Bay Rays fans. Mm-hmm. And if you take a dude like Joe Maddon, you know, well, two things I was going to get at, but if you take, you know, if you take baseball, the first thing I was going to talk about is like, there's such an individual sport, you know, I mean, obviously baseball is a team sport, but the psychos, like those players, I mean, I remember Nomar Garciaparra, like he'd go up to the plate and he'd have that routine with his baseball gloves and the spike and you can't, you know, I have to step over that line. Like they're superstitious and you just have you and your brain up there in a 90-mile fastball. I would think that meditation would be so helpful, would be so incredibly, I mean, you can get so down on yourself. It's such an individual sport within a team sport. And Joe Maddon is such a cool manager because he tries to mix it up and bring humor and relaxation. He brings in like chickens, like a boa constrictors into the, like he's insane, but he's so fun. And I think he's got a little bit of that Pete Carroll, like let's try to do something different and outside the box.
Yeah. And I mean, if you think about it from the neck down at that level, the possibility of the number one and number two fastest men in the world, for example, number two beating number one from the neck down, you know, these tiny, tiny incremental differences. And if you change your diet, change the way you train, I mean, it's 0.5%, maybe 1%.
Yeah.
From the neck up, the potential there to be better than the person standing next to you is largely untapped. And so this is where there are studies being done in with creativity and meditation. And this is where what really defines the best in the world from the neck down, you know, the best in the world are pretty much the same, but it's what's going on from the neck up. And those who realize that and are paying attention to it are truly who we're all writing about and talking about.
Yeah. Right? Oh God. I really wish Pete Carroll was the coach of my New York Giants. We're 0-80.
I thought you were going to say like my softball team.
No, the team I care about the most that
so.
I have a 24-hour problem with, and that's my beloved New York Giants. But yeah, no, if you take the Rays, I mean, it is. It's like he really is. Okay, if you take – basically, he gets more out of those players. I mean, the Tampa Bay payroll is like $165, and they're consistently winning. In fact, one sports writer – I forget who it was predicted them to win the, you know, championship this year. It's like they beg, borrow, and steal. They have no superstars. I mean, they have David Price, and they have, you know, they have a couple. I mean, they've got who's that third baseman that I always joke around as my mom's boyfriend? Carroll, third baseman for the Tampa Bay Rays. Carol just woke up. I'm not going to lie. She just threw up over my boot. I gave her some water and she's looking that up. But that she gets the most out of those players on a limited payroll. I mean, I just think all these teams should just kind of have these epiphanies of like, do you see what's working? I think now, I mean, after Seattle did that season of basically complete dominance and people were still second guessing, they were saying like, oh, it's home field advantage, they can't win on the road, and to go and, you know, outdoor stadium, blah blah blah, you heard it from day one, and to completely, and you know Peyton obviously is like, you know, a genius and like America's sweetheart, so for them to dismantle a team like that,
it's a good day for sports psychologists.
It's a good day for meditation and sports psychologists. Evan Longoria, this is a dream podcast. I'm talking to a woman who knows so much about sports, and I have a fact checker who is actually not hammered. It's pretty spectacular. All right, let's shift some gears. Oh God, there's so much to talk about. I don't really know what. All right, let's do this. Let's do this, and then let's cover some basketball, and then I've got some more fun random questions for you. Gators. Now, you grew up in Gatorville, and your parents are big Gator fans.
They became Gator fans when I started going. I actually was born in Pittsburgh. We moved to Florida when I was 11. So I grew up a Penn State fan.
Oh, no way.
And my parents were big Penn State fans. And I remember, I joke sometimes that I had a harder time accepting my acceptance letter to Florida, and I had a hard time telling my dad because they had the #1 journalism program at the time in the South, and just a really great school, and I was but he just did not believe he could cheer for the Gators because he so hated Steve Spurrier.
Oh yes.
You know, because he had grown up in this, you know, Penn State, you know, you take a knee and you hand the ball to the ref after you score a touchdown, and he had this like visor throwing.
I'm sorry, I can't stand Steve Spurrier. I'm okay with your dad. I think he is always he's just like this pomp. I'm sure he's a nice man. Maybe he's not. I just feel like he's just like this super pompous. Like, I never was a Spurrier fan.
However, you're a Spurrier fan when you're a Gator fan
now. But if my parents had, you know, moved down there when Spurrier, how long did Spurrier coach? He coached forever.
He was there until, you know, I actually remember, what's so funny is remembering that moment and being like, Dad.
Yeah.
I remember getting him a hat. You know, you're going to have to be a Gator fan now. And then they became the hugest Gator fans.
Yeah.
And, you know, he won. We won a lot. And so that running up the score, visor throwing becomes pretty fun when he's on your team.
Totally. He's legitimately.
But
I remember going
from that moment to being, I remember getting on the subway in New York. It was probably 2003, and I remember seeing a call from my dad, and my dad's not a big cell phone user, especially not back then. Oh my God, if my dad's calling me, something happened.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying, are you sitting down? And I thought, oh my God, someone died.
Yeah.
And he told me Steve Spurrier was leaving the Gators. Wow, how far we've come.
Yes.
He's like, he's taken another job, you know, so I don't remember the question now.
Well, I'm sort of the post Spurrier era. In fact, when you said Steve Spurrier, my first thought was South Carolina. Right,
right. Which so, is so my, weird
my,
to me.
My first thought wasn't Florida because when my, in fact, right. I totally forgot he coached Florida for all those years. Because, you know, my whole family's East Coast, like New York. And so my parents retired down to Tampa area maybe like 10 years ago, right? Yeah. So, and then they started like absolutely like everything, you know, Florida, especially, you know, Gators. But it was, you know, the Tim Tebow era.
Right.
And now he's the coach of Ohio State. What's his name? Oh, my God. Carol, wake up. Coach of Ohio State, who's the long-time coach of the Florida Gators. But anyway, they got like obsessed, you know. And also my mom's like super Catholic, so she thought Tim Tebow was like, I'd literally call up and be like, how's your boyfriend? She'd be like, stop it, Aaron. But that era, you know.
Am I supposed to, I didn't know if I'm supposed to answer questions sometimes. I'll just let Carol do it.
Oh, no, I mean, no.
Urban Meyer.
Urban Meyer.
Yeah, I was like,
oh, my God,
I don't know
you please chime in. Of course you know Urban Meyer.
Well, I did, but I didn't want to step on Carol's
part-time job where she shows up hammered. That's so nice. Hey, Carol, can you please thank Alyssa? Because
she's on thin ice already. I don't want to start yelling out player names.
Oh, God. Carol, every time she fax checks, sometimes she sends faxes. No one's got a fax machine, Carol. Anyway, Urban Meyer.
We can't wait for
that. In the studio next to us, there's several drum rolls. I don't know if anyone can hear that. Is there a band, Emmett? What's happening?
It's a couple of pallets getting moved in.
What's a pallet?
They're pallets of something that they need out there.
Doesn't it sound like a marching band?
Pallets of drums.
Yeah.
It sounds like a marching band has just come in. It's all right.
It's opening day.
It's opening day. People are watching baseball, Florida Gators. Okay, so Pittsburgh. So your teams kind of split who you cheer for between Pittsburgh and Florida?
The Steelers and the Gators.
The Steelers and the Gators.
Those are my teams, yeah.
Okay, so I met Lynn Swann.
Oh.
Now, okay. I'm not sure if I told this story on the podcast before, but you get into like really random jobs when you do stand-up comedy. And I got hired to go to the ESPN Times Square, you know, ESPN store, Times Square craziness location, to host a bar mitzvah with Lynn Swann. And the only reason why I said yes, because it was probably like a couple hundred bucks or something, it was just kind of to keep like, you know, grab a mic and be like, okay, you guys, everyone go to the hockey area. You know, and it was kind
of fascinated by bar mitzvahs.
First of all, it
why was
like,
Lynn so, it was like a Pittsburgh fan maybe
they
with
must
a kid
have paid
who had
them.
The cash to just...
I mean, if you have your child's bar mitzvah at the ESPN zone in Times Square...
The whole ESPN zone.
Uh-huh. Wow. It was like a Saturday or Sunday morning for hours. They rented out the ESPN zone. So you're talking about $1 gazillion, and they probably threw God knows how much money at Lynn Swann. So I hear Lynn Swann. I have no interest in doing someone's bar mitzvah like Saturday morning. But I hear Lynn Swann. I'm like, oh my God, yes, I'm going to meet Lynn Swann. He was totally lovely. But the crazy thing is the kids had no idea who Lynn Swann was.
Right.
And the marching band continues on behind us. But no one, the kids didn't know who Lynn Swann was. So they were like, I
wasted
don't,
money by mom.
Totally yeah. wasted money. And they gave out like he signed a couple footballs. Right. And I was trying to figure out like, how do I steal one of these?
Right.
Footballs? And then there was a baseball signed by like someone else or whatever. And I remember looking at a kid being like, you know what? I'll give you this baseball if you give me that football signed by Lynn Swann. And then I almost got fired. But, you know, I've had like a little bit of a soft spot for the Steelers over the years just because of my interaction with Lynn Swann. So Steelers, all right, your teams are Steelers, Gators. And then we can talk about Gators basketball. And then baseball is at the Pirates?
It is, but I have to be honest. I played softball growing up, and I was a huge baseball fan. And there was this moment living in Florida. We lived in, you know, spring trainingville. All my friends were big baseball fans, and I started to get a little embarrassed of the Pirates. I was in like sixth.
Some
I remember being
years.
In like sixth grade, and I just started telling people. I think, you know, it was like 1985, 86. And the Mets were fantastic. And I had a couple friends who were Mets fans. And I just started telling people I was a Mets fan.
Oh, really?
And I really did love the Mets of that era.
Yeah.
My lucky
they
number
were great.
To this day, if you know, you can get into any of my accounts knowing that
okay,
Daryl Strawberry.
Okay, I'm going to write this down. Everybody write this down.
Knowing Daryl Strawberry was my favorite player. So every uniform I've had in my life has 18 on the back of it. So I legitimately loved some of their players.
Yeah.
I was a catcher, so I loved Gary Carter. But... Yeah, I just think I just started telling people, and then out of sheer embarrassment of the Pirates, and I carried them with me, and I was really a Mets fan. And living in New York, I would always choose Mets over Yankees, even though my best friend Lindsay Barra, who is a sports writer for us, has indoctrinated me into the Yankee world. But I there came a point where I was like, you know what, this is not cool. I should. I'm from Pittsburgh. I love Pittsburgh.
So you've reclaimed the Pirates.
It's been a few years, and it makes me really happy when they're doing well. And today to see
all the Yankees
to see them
on
on opening day to see ESPN showing the opening ceremonies of a Pirates game is really really cool. You know,
that's
and
awesome.
I love hearing my dad tell stories of the days when going to skip school and go see the Pirates back in
did
the
did he watch
in the 70s.
Did he see like Roberto Clemente?
Oh, he saw Roberto Clemente
wow,
play
that's awesome.
In person. You know, skip
so
school
cool.
to do it and. So that's really cool. And that era of all sports I'm a little enamored with.
Oh, totally.
But yeah, it's really cool. I love Andrew McCutchen. Who doesn't?
Well, who doesn't? Yeah, he's a dream.
I loved watching his mom sing the national anthem today on opening day, which I just thought was really, really
that's
cool.
So
apparently,
awesome.
She'd done it one other time, but you know, that's such a Pirates thing. You know, I hope they keep the mentality that they've had in the lean years,
yeah,
that make, you know, even when I'm in Pittsburgh, you know, there was never a question if it was baseball season, we'd go to a game because every single night is fireworks night and free jersey night, and they have the best giveaways and promotions in sports, you know,
yeah,
because they knew that they weren't winning. So I hope that they keep that mentality, sort of that Clippers mentality versus the Lakers, you know, even when they're winning.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. They should. No, it's so fun because, you know, I have a huge I've probably said this every podcast, but I have a huge problem with Bud Selig. I think he's the downfall of baseball. And you know, I really, it's so fun. You know, I grew up a Yankee fan. I started watching when I was 5, and I'm constantly apologizing for the Yankees, right? Not apologizing. I'm just like, when people are like, "Oh, who's your team?" I'm like, "Here we go." I can never even say I'm a Yankee fan without people just berating me, you know, except when I'm in New York City. And I always say, like, and then people are like, "Oh, the Yankees, they buy all their players." And I'm like, well, it's not a Yankee problem. It's a baseball problem. Right. They don't fix any of these rules of, you know, market sharing and salary cap. Like, so I'm sorry that I happen to grow up in New York being like a Yankee fan since I was a little kid. But this year I decided I'm not apologizing. I'm just going to be like, yeah, I'm a Yankee fan. Yeah, we buy a bunch of our players. everyone would. Look at Boston. Look in L.A. And you know what I mean?
We're
it's
playing
not
within
fair.
The rules. Yeah.
It's not fair that New York has more money, but it is the way it is. So when a team like the Pirates come back, you know, through farm club, through good drafting or whatever it is, and now they're super competitive, I love that. I love that. It's not like I'm a baseball fan before I'm a Yankee fan. You know what I mean? So I love cheering for Tampa Bay. I love cheering for small market teams.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Like, you have to be an asshole not to cheer for the Pirates. Oh, I hate the Pirates. All right. Well, you know, I mean, like, if the Cubs were in the World Series, everyone would cheer for the Cubs.
Of course.
So it's super fun to have the Pirates back. It's awesome. And now you're like Mets. You're like Mets and Pirates. I just love that you were like, I can't be a Pirates fan. I'm going to be a Mets fan.
There was a year at 2006 when the Gators and everyone at the office. One of the cool things about when I was working in the office at the magazine when we were based in New York is they really encourage you to keep your sports fandom. You know, we
That's
don't want to
awesome.
Beat it out of you by, you know, giving you a backstage pass and sort of learning too much about sports. And, you know, we don't want to keep you from being a fan. So when your team was in a championship, they would make sure you were there to cover it or just get you tickets.
That's
and you're there.
So cool.
And I had been in Detroit and seen the Steelers win and then left to go to the and in that time where the Gators had just won the football national championship, the Steelers won, and then I left to go to the Olympics, came back. The Gators had that back-to-back championship season.
Oh, my God.
So they in basketball. And so baseball play comes around, and the Mets – I remember I was in Europe when this happened, and the Mets were one game from the World Series. And I remember our editor-in-chief at the time walking out and just being like,
this is a dream.
It's unfair, but if the Mets win, I'm giving you a book deal. And it's just going to be called, you know, everyone wants to be on my team. My team always wins.
Your team always wins. That's awesome.
But they ended up, St. Louis went to that.
Yeah, I remember that. I was cheering for the Mets. I like the Mets. I'm not like a Yankee fan that hates the Mets. I'm like, why would I hate the – I don't know. I have so many friends in New York City. I lived in New York City like practically my whole life that are huge Mets fans, and it's super exciting.
You like them.
It's like two teams. It's like, I like the Giants. I'm like, I like the Jets too. I mean, they're New Yorkers, you know, before New York teams before I'm going to root for, you know, the Patriots or something. Well, the Patriots are close. Yeah. And they're an evil empire. But anyway, no, there's obviously good stories out of New England. But anyway, they are the arch rivals. But the Tampa Bay, the Florida Gators basketball, we have a connection to because we moved to Rhode Island when I was 12. And Billy Donovan, like, led PC when I was, like, a little kid. Not even a little kid, a kid. So we've always loved, the Foley family loved Billy Donovan. So when he took over the Gators, it was like, you know, dream. So let's boom. Now, look at this.
And here he
seamless
still is.
Seamless transition. Florida Gators. I just got back from the hot spot of Ruskin, Florida. Oh, God. Someone's hip went out, and I think it rained a lot. Those were the highlights of the trip. But I always go down this time of year because it's my mom's birthday, and we watch a lot of March Madness. So cool. It's so fun. Yeah. Their brackets. You know what's interesting?
Did they fill out one of the Buffett brackets?
They didn't fill out the Buffett bracket because I just gave them a new computer. They couldn't even get online for a while. But I actually wound up not filling out the Buffett bracket because you had to do a Yahoo account, give them your cell phone number. You had to answer all these questions like home ownership. And I was like, I'm going to be out in the first hour. I was like, screw it. I'm not going to do it. But I did do a lot of other bracket pools. And my brackets are so – by, I think, Saturday of the first round, this is the first year where I took some serious risks. And boy, did they backfire. I had Oklahoma State on the shoulders of Marcus Smart going deep into the tournament. Boom, they were out first game to Gonzaga. So I made some horrible choices. But let's recap a little March Madness because it just ended. We're with the Final Four this past weekend. So on the men's side, and we'll talk about the women's side too. Florida, I had in UConn. Now, I've been cheering since UConn since I was a little kid because my aunt and uncle live in Storrs, Connecticut. They came out of nowhere and beat Michigan State. Well, first of all, they came out of nowhere and beat, I thought, second round Villanova. I had them losing to Villanova. But UConn, I don't know what has gotten into them, but it's super exciting. And they beat Florida State. My friend bets a lot on basketball. And she's constantly texting me, like, for more information. She's like, all right, Michigan State, UConn, like, I forget what the spread was. And I was like, and I never tell her to bet spreads in March Madness because it's too much. Yeah. A 16, you know, or like a 12 seed can beat a 5. Like, there's no rhyme or reason. I was like, stay away from the spreads. Stay away from betting in March Madness. But she still does. But that was the only time where I was like, yeah, I definitely was like, oh, I think Michigan State's totally going to handle UConn. Boom! UConn wins. It was pretty exciting. And then Wisconsin and Kentucky, four freshmen. Kentucky coming out of nowhere. I'm thrilled. Now, have you been like into the March Madness world? Like, have you covered the Final Four or women's side or men's side?
I haven't. I haven't. Yeah, maybe next year. I haven't done a lot of basketball.
Yeah.
College or NFL. College or NBA. When I moved out here to Los Angeles, I've certainly had the opportunity to do a bunch of Lakers games and Clippers, and working on bigger stories. But I haven't. It depends on the year. Some years I don't miss a single game. This year, I've been on the road so much that now that I'm home, I've been spending some time catching up with friends who forgot that
you were in Russia for like 17 months.
But I have been watching a good number of games, and it's been a lot of fun to watch. I have the Gators winning, of course I do.
Of course.
So I have one team, and I saw this stat today that came across the ESPN stats desk, which I think sometimes it's just, I call it the Gator Hater desk.
Oh.
And it said that the Gators, I mean, it's a true stat, the Gators are 36-0 against every team in the country except for UConn and Wisconsin, and they're 0-2 against.
Wow.
So they beat Kentucky three times this year, but they've lost it.
Which never happens. But Kentucky did not look good. They looked a little bit better during the SEC final game. I was just like, all right. They had some good momentum. But yeah, I want to say I picked Florida, but UConn could win the whole thing. Wisconsin could win the whole thing. I've got a soft spot for Wisconsin. So the Kentucky's been super fun, but I'm going for Wisconsin. UConn, Florida, honest to God, I love both teams. So whoever has the ball, I'll probably cheer for. Although it would probably be a happier Marion Dick household if Florida won, so I'll probably go with Florida just for that reason. But I'd be happy. Honestly, I'd be super happy. I'd be happy with any of the picks, except, I don't know. I don't really want Kentucky to win the whole thing. My friend Mary, who watches this, listens to this podcast, is going to be so angry that I say that. But just because they're in it so much that I kind of always do the underdog, like the Wisconsin winning the whole thing would be adorable, you know. All right, two things. I know we're winding down here. Women's side, I know this podcast is going to add in a couple of days, but watch these women's games. I'm going to be watching all day today. Baylor, Notre Dame. Notre Dame's still undefeated. Texas A&M, UConn. UConn's undefeated. When are they not? Maryland plays Louisville. Now, Maryland beat Tennessee in an upset yesterday. North Carolina beat South Carolina in an upset. That was the only one I picked. I picked North Carolina over South Carolina because the North Carolina coach, Sylvia Hatchell, has had cancer, And I was like, right. these girls are going to rise up because there's an outside chance that their coach could come back like during the Final Four. And I was like, no, I already started crying. I was like, no, they're going to win. And they upset. So I think they're playing Stanford. I don't know if they'll get by Stanford, but if you guys out there, if you're betting, I'd go with North Carolina.
Do you fill out a women's bracket as well?
I do. I fill out the women's bracket and men's bracket. And the women's bracket, except for these two major upsets, I swear to God, you can just do it by ranking. It's uncanny how the women's bracket stays 1, 2, 3, 4 the entire time. Except for this year.
Except for this year.
Last podcast, I was like, you guys, if you're filling out women's bracket, just do it by like, you know, 1 and 2. And then Tennessee gets dumped and South Carolina gets dumped. Sorry about that, guys. All right. I'm trying to think. Okay. Just do one more thing and then we'll have a little moment. All right. So you've covered it all. You've covered Olympics and Super Bowls and all this stuff. Two quick questions. One, like, what's been like one thing where you're like, oh my, like you're in the middle of it, right? Of this game or this event. And you're like, holy crap. Like I'm living my dream. Like if you were like growing up, you're like, this is my dream sequence. Like, have you had those moments where you're like, I'm doing it?
There've been so many. I mean, I think because of so many of the sports that I cover now aren't the sports that I grew up dreaming about covering. Yeah. You know, I couldn't have even imagined the things I've been able to do.
Yeah.
So if it was something that I grew up thinking about, it would have to be a football moment. You know, certainly I've done some games as a sideline reporter, you know, being able to be that person with the microphone in hand who's running up to a coach or a player, you know, grabbing a medic during a game and asking the questions that I know my mom and dad are sitting at home watching the game thinking and wishing they could ask. That's a huge privilege, and those have been cool moments. You know, seeing a book that I'd written sitting on my desk, that was certainly something I dreamed about doing as a kid. But I have to say, when I think of those moments, a lot of times they're not working. There are moments when I'm able to give to the people around me their sort of make-a-wish. So I think of taking my mother who was maybe the biggest Steelers fan in the world, taking her to the Super Bowl. And I remember sitting in the stands and the 50-yard line with these amazing tickets. And, and you know, being with her and her watching the team run out into the field, you know, taking my dad and my sister to a Steelers game in Tampa. And, you know, those to me are some of the like
– super cool.
You know, I made it, sure, but like I was able to do this for my parents or for my sister or for a friend who like loves the Lakers and bring them to a game you know, sort of those moments when you're like, wow, this is really cool and I get to share it with someone
because
you know, you're usually doing it on your own. You're flying all over the world and covering these amazing events and you're doing it by yourself. So to take friends and family and
super cool. That's amazing. That's super sweet and fantastic.
So start your list.
Start my list. Jesus, your resume is like my dream sequence. I'm like, what do you mean? You just went to Sochi.
You like to come?
Oh, God. Well, I'm just going to email you every single day where I need to be and what I need to
cover. I have friends
who
do that.
Fantastic.
Do you have tickets?
March Madness is huge bucket list. But honestly, you could name anything and I'd be like, let's do, you know what I mean? I want to go to every ballpark. I want to, like, you know what I mean? I need to play like a doubles match with you know, the Williams sisters. I have a lot to do. I have a lot to do. I want to play horse with like every Lisa Leslie.
List. Yeah.
I feel
bougie
like
bougie list there.
Yes.
I just want to play doubles with the.
Oh, I've got so many dreams. I feel like though, if I played horse with Lisa Leslie and I gave her a blindfold and I made her do shots, I could totally beat her. that's the challenge, Lisa Leslie, I'm throwing down. All right, everybody, opening day of baseball. We'll talk more baseball throughout the season. Happy opening day of baseball. We already covered that. We've got 38 days to the NFL draft. I wrote down a bunch of random notes. We're going to end every single podcast. Of course, I've said this 3 weeks in a row now. I don't exactly know what I'm going to call it. It's a celebratory moment. My really good friend, Paul Sullivan, who has an awesome blog called Sully Baseball, he suggested calling it closing out the show with the greatest closer of all time, Mariano Rivera, going, all right, let's Mariano this and close out the show. That's kind of fun. Maybe we'll do that this week. One of my favorite moments of March Madness, and we will get a website so I can link this on, is a really fun player. He's a freshman for Arizona. His name is Rondae Hollis Jefferson. He, when he goes to the free throw line, He does like the best shimmy you've ever want to see. You know, Kevin Durant has that little shoulder move, you know, but he full on shimmies. Like, I'm shimmying right now. I know you can't watch this, but I'm doing a very fantastic shimmy. And then it cuts to the band, and the entire Arizona band shimmies with their instruments. And it's the greatest moment ever. It's adorable. Apparently, he shimmied and then didn't shimmy, but he it's like a 90% like free throw rate when he shimmies. So the coach is like, start the shimmying. So that's the moment. That's our closing moment. Everybody Google Rondae Hollis-Jefferson shimmy, and it goes with a band shimmy, and then the band does a lot of dance sequences, which is always my favorite moment. So that's your moment of wow, or I don't know, Mariano closing out moment, something. Thank you so much for being one of my favorite guests of all time. Where can people, let's give you a shout out. I know you have your a website, but tell us like where we can find you and see you and all that stuff.
You can find me at ESPN.com, most of the – and ESPN, the magazine. It's also online. So, yeah, if you just Google my really hard-to-spell name.
I'm going to give the correct
– And, X Games in Austin. I'll give a little plug for X Games Austin. I'll be one of our on-air reporters.
So nice. When are
June
the X Games?
June 4th through 7th. I hope that's accurate. Thursday
we'll double
to Sunday
check
in Carroll.
Carol!
In Austin, Texas.
All right, so look for Alyssa in Austin, Texas. I'm actually going to be in Austin, Texas. Unfortunately, it's not the same time for the Moon Tower Comedy Festival.
Oh, wow, cool.
In April. Just so you can Google her, it's Alyssa, R-O-E-N-I-G-K. Read her, watch her, get her books. Thank you so much for being such a wonderful guest. Everybody, Sports Without Balls fans, have the best week of your life.